So why don't you explain what the Windmills Project is and what your goals are with it?
My name's Amrik. I'm sort of possibly the conceptualist. I've got with me Stacey, who is the sorceress. She's the lead vocalist and the talisman of the project. And also next to me, I have Cave, who is part of the production team, and also he creates all the visuals. So the three of us, basically, we pretty much were the origin of it. And in terms of, you know, there was maybe another two or three people, but we wanted to, rather than form a band or make a record, we wanted to write an opera, effectively, but grandiloquent though it may sound, you know, it was just something that we fancied doing.
Now, how would being in a project such as the Windmills differ from the Windmills being a band?
We had no idea of sitting in a transit van and running up and down motorways and doing shit gigs. Because life is far too short. Mm-hmm.
So you're basically going to be more of a studio project than a touring entity.
We love the idea of live installations, you know, from, you know, art shows and installations. We like the idea of that. But obviously, you know, if you want to do a show at the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, then you're not going to do it from, you know, having a few fans in Southampton.
Now, you've got an EP currently called Death Disco. Why don't you explain the concept behind that?
Yeah, well, the Death Disco is the first act of the EP. Basically, the whole opera is centered around, it's based around, we looked at Tommy and we looked at Quadrophenia, and you know, I'm a little older than Stacey. She's obviously 21. I'm a lot older than that. But I showed her things, and you know, you can learn from the past. And we thought, well, you know, we've got those sort of like, those, you know, even the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
There's,
you know,
a lot
those
of lessons in the studio.
There's so many lessons there, but nobody has ever done anything like that for the last 20, 30 years, and we felt that, you know, we could, you know, we could possibly try and attempt to write something. The other big influence is Nick Rogue's film, The Man Who Fell to Earth, starring David Bowie. And we liked that film and the idea of like the alien being sent to Earth to observe the sort of morality and the mentality of the and we kind of like cast Stacey as the sorceress. So she had been sent from, but you know, you don't quite know whether she's been sent by Satan or by God. You know, she might be the archangel of redemption, or she might be the dark angel sent to cast the planet out of its misery. You know, we like that kind of, you know, that contrast that possibly we could play with. And you know, I think ultimately we would like her to have a nice heart rather than a dark heart, but one never knows.
That would be saved for the next chapter, basically.
Well, the idea is that we've already got the next chapter in operation, and it's the whole thing is called She's Lost Control. And she becomes like the Phoenix, you know, where she can control the planet, she can burn it, or she can just save it. And the whole of the next chapter is dedicated to whether her conflict of interest and her consciousness, you know, is whether she thinks, is humanity worth saving? I mean, I sometimes wake up in the morning and think humanity is not worth saving either, you know. But we thought the second one will be the conflict, and the third one will be the final act of the opera, will be where she makes a decision one way or the other. She either saves it. It all sounds a bit Marvel Age of Ultron, but
the resolution, basically.
Yeah, the resolution will be in the third act. And you know, it's something that we deliberately, you know, conceived. It's not an accident. We, you know, we have wanted to write this like this.
Now, is this something that you could picture as a film in the future?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, our first thing was we don't want to. Who wants to do a gig? And nobody put their hands up. And now, and everybody says, well, you know, come. And luckily, we have Cave with us on board, who is an absolutely fantastic filmmaker. I don't know if you've seen the visuals.
Yeah, actually, I have.
They're very political. Mm-hmm. It's all about, you know, the sorceress has come to the earth, and she is observing, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know. And she's like kind of, she's not commentating on it. She's like, you know, observing it, and she has to make a decision. And we try to put that into the films, and, you know, and that's kind of all we can do. We can't make a movie because we don't have the budgets.
Well, it almost seems like some of the video footage had a hidden message, as well as the album cover.
Oh yeah, if you've seen on the album cover, there are like five or six hidden symbols that you probably haven't seen.
Actually, I think I recognize one or two.
well,
one
you
above.
You need to find the other ones.
Okay, well, I think there's one above the front windmill, and it's kind of an Egyptian style wing.
No, I don't think it is. I think
okay.
The symbols that we have in there are basically all the symbols of all the major religions in the world.
Okay,
and also the anarchy symbol and the disarmament symbol, the CND symbol. So no nuclear weapons. But we've got like kind of the crescent of Islam and the Star of David and various symbols. It's all there, so because you know we are in a state of holy war or unholy war, you know, as we speak, and it's going on around the world, and we're not documenting anything that isn't happening. You know, it's all out there.
And I also see the most obvious is different forms of energy exploitation. Like you've got wind energy, you've got
well, that's it. Yeah, that's a key feature of it. It's all about the PAP, you know, the control. It's like, you know, why is Putin so powerful? Because he's got control of energy. You know, he's an oligarch and you know, quite a despicable person. But and Russia had died the death in the Cold War, but he's still almost omnipotent because of the control that he has in terms of the power.
Yeah, when he's not president, he's prime minister, and when he's not prime minister, he's president.
Exactly, you know, and he just changes jobs every four years, and but it's like it's a tyranny, you know. A lot of the world is ruled by tyrants, and we don't even know them. You know, some of them are our friends.
Yeah, some of them aren't even government. I mean, like I, you know, have a lot of suspicion about giant corporations.
Yeah,
you know. I mean, one of the things I had a discussion with a friend of mine yesterday about Mark Zuckerberg, and he literally has the personal data of 1/3 of the planet's population.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it is the information war, information and power.
Exactly. So
there's nothing else left in the world. Nobody cares if 1,000 species are going to be extinct in the next 20 years. They're only concerned about conservation of power, wealth.
Yeah, and a lot of people think that money is the root of all evil, but I kind of look at money as a tool.
Money is just a tool, yes, it's a weapon.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It used to be the cross. The Christians used the cross as a weapon.
Yep, exactly.
You know, the Islamists, they have this great thing about oppressing women, and it's all about sort of like, you know, I understand Islamic religion, but, you know, purdah was always meant to be a period during public holidays where women were going to be in the proximity of other males, and they had a thing where, you know, the women in those holy periods would be sort of like discreet and modest, and you look at it now and they want them to fucking wear these things 24 hours a day.
Yeah, I see exactly what you're saying. Now,
that's not purdah, that's fucking hell.
Well, it's oppression is what it is. And
yeah.
don't you think that for a group to achieve power that they have to basically stomp somebody down. I mean, it, like, you know, the religions fighting each other. But I mean, I'll go back even further. I don't think the Nazis would have come to power in, if they didn't have a scapegoat.
No, they needed the scapegoat. You know, the Jews were just perfect for Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler was, you know, actually not that clever. You know, he was, in fact, Nigel Farage reminds me of very much of Adolf Hitler. Luckily, that kind of scenario is not very highly unlikely to happen in the UK. But he was a bit of a bumbling idiot, I think, Adolf Hitler. I don't think, because he took on an economy that was in recession, and he improved the economy, and then he basically then found the scapegoat to introduce National Socialism.
Yeah, and what I don't understand was, like, you know, well, I mean, it makes total sense that he would pick the Jews in this case, because the Jews historically have always been a peaceful people, you know, but what I don't understand is how he was able to make sense of all of his beliefs. Like, case in point, the Nazis celebrated Christmas, which is the birthday of a Jew.
But was he a Jew? I don't think the Jews fancied Jesus that much, to tell you the truth. They're the ones who betrayed him.
Mm-hmm. True. But I mean, it's well perceived that, you know, in a lot of Christian circles that Christ was Jewish.
I think my personal sort of opinion of it is he was the end of Judaism, you know, because he was... if you look at Islam is quite happy to accept Moses and Abraham and all the prophets. They accept the prophets and they accept Jesus as a Jewish prophet, but they don't accept anything else. And then they think Muhammad is the next prophet. So I don't think this is very. The Romans thought that he was the king of the Jews, but I don't think Jesus ever, to my knowledge, I don't think he represented, I don't think the Jews were that interested in him, and I don't think he represented them and their hierarchies, and, you know, they were already well established, the Jews.
I don't think it says anywhere in any version of the Bible where Jesus defined himself with his religion.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. I don't think he ever says he's a Jew.
Mm-hmm. I think he pretty much accepted everybody.
Yeah, but the Jews weren't inclusive. You know, the Jews are not inclusive now. I mean, I hate to sound like a bigot or a racist.
No, you actually make a good point, because I think it comes down to human nature, and by human nature, we kind of protect ourselves by putting ourselves in groups and cliques.
Yeah, it's completely natural, you know, because that's what society is all about. Society is that defines society, that you get a group of people who think the same, and you develop together. You know, that's and it has to happen. It's an inevitable part of evolution.
And it's not just with religions either. Religion is just the surface of it. You could define yourself with your political party, or even just the friends that you have.
Absolutely, it's an anthropomorphic or something, a word similar to that.
nice. Now, with the windmills, it sounds like you get that deep in some of your music.
Yeah, it's all about, you know, I mean, if you listen to a track like Shantytown, you know, you've got this, you know, even Stacey was like kind of, I think when I first...
had a lot of questions.
She had a lot of questions.
Yeah, I didn't really understand anything about it until Amrik explained it all in the studio beforehand. We'd go through the lyrics and I'd be like, this bit, and then this bit, and this bit, and I'd get a history lesson with each part.
Nice.
It's the idea of, like, you know, society developing, and, you know, because we all think that the pirates in Somalia are really evil and ISIS are really evil, and everybody's just, they are all just the axis of evil, you know, as Mr. Bush has told us. But in actual fact, you know, as the song says, the pirate is like, he's probably 16 years old and he's got a knife between his teeth and he's in his sister's raped and put to the sword, you know.
Well, I mean, it's good that you brought that up, because the message I got with that particular track was that we shouldn't define ourselves by our deeds. It's who we are. It's who we are in the inside. And I kind of got that feeling after 9/11. If you remember, after September 11th, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm sure that's in everybody's mind. That the one thing that, like, well, me as an American, you know, like, since it happened in the United States, I mean, it was very personal on my end. But what one thing I noticed amongst the people in my country was that we didn't spend that much time, if any, to try to figure out why they were mad at us.
Well, exactly. Nobody does. You know, there's like, historically, it's you're only looking at, you know, I'm married to a woman who's half Maltese and half Irish, and she's, as far as she's concerned, history sort of like, you know, is, you can't talk about slavery anymore because it happened a long time ago and people weren't so intelligent. But a lot of these issues are not really that long ago, and if we can't learn from our recent past, then we are all doomed to hell in a handcart. Yeah. And the issue in the Middle East is almost like less than 70 years old. You know, there was no Iraq during the World War II. It was called the Fourth Quadrant. It wasn't a country. There was no Kuwait. Kuwait was another, I don't know the name that they gave to Kuwait, but it was two oil wells.
Well, and the only true country in that area at the time, I believe, was Saudi Arabia.
Which
is literally, Saudi is a family name, and it literally translates to Arabia of the Saudi family.
Yeah, it's their own sort of like, you know, fiefdom that the Americans have propped up since day one and allowed them to sort of basically control. You know, that's a terrible state, Saudi Arabia, and they've got no interest in helping world progression or world peace, or, you know, they've all those, you know, I don't know what you call them, the kingdoms, I suppose. Are they kingdoms or?
Yeah, they are, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, sheikdoms or kingdoms, you know, they're just totally controlled. But how can the West have supported all that? Because obviously oil, power is at the source of everything.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, it is, not to sound anti-American, but in a way, it, because this is very dangerous to say this in my country, even though we have freedom of speech, but in a way, it is our fault. And the reason I say that is, after World War I, that area was just chopped up, you know, between America, Britain, and France into separate countries, and they just literally just spent an afternoon making up borders. And
then
And then at the end of World War II, you know, as much as I do believe this, I do believe that the Jewish people deserved a state of their own after what they had gone through in the Holocaust, you know, because there was still rampant anti-Semitism.
You could have put it in Greenland.
Yeah,
nobody would have fought them there.
Yeah, exactly. But they stuck it right in the middle of all the Muslims.
Yeah.
They had to stick them right in the middle of Palestine.
The most, the Jews.
Yep, exactly. Well, I mean, but I mean, I see both.
The Americans would never put Eskimos in there, would they?
No.
The Eskimos would say, I don't like these Muslims. They're a bit fierce. I'm off out of here.
Exactly.
The Jews would have stayed there. They sold the Jews down the river.
Well, but I mean, I do see both sides of it. I think.
But you look at Israel now, you know, it's like all their rivers. You cannot even bathe in any of the rivers in Israel. Yeah, they're so
exactly.
polluted. What kind of place is that to bring up children?
No, exactly.
They are the last bastion. They are the frontier. America has put them there as a frontier of war.
Yeah. So, and do you think
I would have put the Jews in Canada. Give them a nice life. Australia, you know, look at bloody Tasmania. Yeah. Give him a nice place.
I'd have given him New Jersey. but, you know, they've got half of Manhattan.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about it. But
I don't think the Jews really needed a state.
No. Well, I don't know. I'm kind of torn on that. I mean, because like I said,
they never had a state before the Second World War and the First World War. So, and it never, there was never any clamor by the Jews that we wanted our state back after 100 years. And
you know what I think part of the problem was is if you remember how the United States was before World War II, we were almost closed off. We literally did not give a shit about anybody else. We were just like, let's just like make corn and cars and, you know, and like leave everybody alone and stuff. If you notice, we didn't even want to fight in World War I.
Oh, absolutely. The Americans didn't want to bloody know.
Yeah. Yeah. We were like a live and let live type nation, but World War II kind of made us a superpower because it beefed up our economy. You know, so do you think, I mean, I've got this theory that, and tell me if I'm wrong, but I think maybe we became a superpower too quick and we didn't know how to handle it.
I think you got a point. Because nobody, I'm totally against the whole sort of like idea of nation states being inherently evil. I don't think they are. Maybe like North Korea might be a little bit bad, but I don't think America or anybody has actually tried to do this with a deliberate maleficent sort of way, you know, in terms of trying to fuck people over. But it's just the end result is all we can see. We can only judge on what's happened, and it looks to us like, yes, obviously the oil was of paramount importance.
And
some considerations got lost along the way, and some humanitarian considerations. Because there's no reason why we couldn't have a peaceful coexistence in this world. It's not that big. Everybody, you know, the world is a small place. The globalization of this world has like been fantastic.
Yeah, and I think part of it also might have been the sudden introduction of the atomic age, which is actually kind of represented on your album cover, because I think after that first test in Arizona, you know, the U.S. government was kind of holy shit, what did we just build?
Yeah.
Because I read a book on this actually where they debated on whether to use it or not. They were actually thinking about contacting the Japanese government and showing them what it could do off the coast where nobody could get hurt.
Yeah,
they had actually thought of that at some point.
That's weird,
you know. But I think part of that is like, okay, we just designed and built something that we didn't know was going to be this destructive.
Yeah, I think you got a point.
So, but well, you know, let's bring this back to the windmills. I mean, how do you represent strong topics like that using not just your music, but film and video?
Well, if I can pass the phone on to Cave for a minute, he can talk to you maybe about the way he works with the visuals and stuff.
Okay. I think we've always been big fans of animation. And we discovered a guy called Phil Malloy, who's been around since the 80s. He did some MTV iDance. And has gone on to make some sort of satirical, grotesque animations. And he seemed to be saying basically the same things as we were thinking. And the two were a natural marriage. That's how the visual sort of came about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I, you know what? It's funny because I remember the MTV animations during when they were promoting the Peter Max collection.
Yeah.
You know, when he bought all those Corvettes and he was going to, they had this contest where they were going to give them all away.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that's almost iconic from the 80s.
Oh, what's happened? Has it cut out?
Hello.
Oh, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, yeah. Sorry,
Oh no. What I was just saying was, you know, that has almost an iconic look, and I almost recognized that immediately when I saw when I saw that video.
Yeah. As I say, I mean, the whole project is not just about music; it's about sort of the visual representation. And it's also, yeah, sort of about sort of, you know, social, political, you know, sort of religious values. And everything in you see in those videos has been, it's incorporated in there. So it was a natural choice.
Now, are you going to continue with that style? Because, I mean, it works really well with the music.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've got a new one. Tell him about the new one.
Yeah, there is a, yeah, there's
an exclusive for you.
There is an exclusive. There's a new, yeah, sort of video, which is, I think,
finished.
It's just been finished. And so, yeah, I think Amrit can give you the details on the links for that. When we do want to, yeah, sort of evolve this idea, I think we wanted to go basically with the visuals against the grain, you know, even though it's, you know, sort of house music and electronica. We didn't want to, you know, have the classic, you know, sort of MTV video.
Well, you know what else it gave me a reminder of, not in style at all, but kind of in meaning, was certain scenes in Pink Floyd's Wall.
Yes, yeah.
We're too right.
Again, you know, another, yeah, sort of narrative, you know, sort of done in film. Again, you know, we're big fans of that, you know. We're fans of, yeah, animators, you know, satirists, cartoonists, Ralph Steadman, all these characters have all been a big influence on us.
Now, do you think that the project could be an ongoing thing, like a story without end?
I think with the first album, we want to tell the story in three parts. It will evolve into something else after that.
We're going to be like Game of Thrones, Stacey's.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because what I was thinking was, is originally Star Wars was going to be one trilogy, then it was two, now it's going to be three, obviously.
Yeah,
you know, if it could be something like that, because you know, there's never really an end.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I think as, you know, sort of writers and artists and, you know, everyone is evolving, you know, on a sort of a monthly basis. So, yeah, I mean, what the next album could be completely different in a different direction. Although, you know, the...
It will still retain the narrative.
Yeah, the narrative will still be the same, yeah.
Nice. Now, in 10 or 20 years, you know, with a project this great, with a project that's this grandiose and has this much focus on itself, where do you think it will be, or where do you think it will be remembered 10, 20 years from now?
That's interesting. Hopefully, yes. A thought-provoking sort of project. Yeah, people remember it for the message in it, rather than it just being a, you know, sort of an overnight pop, you know, or a club, you know, record that people forget about, and you know, and you move on to the next one. Yeah, hopefully it will stay on people's playlists, and you know, people who are sort of interested in what we're doing.
Nice. Now, where can we find it online, and how are you guys promoting it?
Well, I'll pass you on to the man who knows all about that.
The last thing in the world that we have actually been addressing is how do we make it available? Because strangely enough, our whole concept has been like we're not really that bothered about making it available.
Well, because yeah, I've noticed that, because it's almost done in a guerrilla style.
Oh yeah, no, because we haven't put it up. It's free on air on YouTube, and we quite encourage people. You know, probably about 3,000 hits, I think, across the EP already on YouTube. And we're quite happy with that. You know, it's not we are not doing this as a mercantile project where, you know, we're trying to achieve sort of a step up the rung of pop stardom, because we have no interest in pop stardom at all. And we will we're now being forced by people to make it available. Stacey, mainly. The sorceress has commanded me to make this record available. Nice. Because her friends want to buy it.
So, well, where can we find you guys online for updates?
Well, we're on Twitter, which is at stationk.uk. And that's pretty much all we just have a tiny little internet presence, but we're getting DJs every day now from around the world contacting us, and it's kind of nice, you know, it's the people are finding us, and we've got, like, you know, some people like David Quantick, who's quite a major broadcast journalist in the UK, and they're finding us without us finding them.
Well, you know? And it's good that you brought that up too, because you guys recently topped the charts at Kings of Spins Top 20.
Yeah, that was great, you know. And if you look at that chart, you got people like, obviously, Mark Ronson and
Bruno Mars.
Yeah, Bruno Mars, and it's a proper chart. I know that chart because it's probably the biggest EDM chart in the US, and for us to get number one there is like a fantastic result.
So how did that happen? I mean, did you guys give it to the right person, or did somebody just find it?
No, Eddie Gordon is the head of Kings of Spins, and he used to manage Pete Tong, and Lewis Dean is his right-hand man. He used to have a Ministry of Sound radio show in the UK, and we just emailed them the tracks, basically, so... we've got a 10-inch vinyl that we've made of the EP that we haven't put into any shops because we like it so much that we don't want anyone else to have it.
Nice. You plan on releasing it, right? Or else you wouldn't have had it made.
Well, no. I like it so much that I want to keep it. I am like fucking, you know, who's the character in Lord of the Rings?
Oh, no.
This is my precious.
Nice.
I'm the Gollum.
Yep, Gollum, that's it.
We have made these 10-inch vinyls. We've manufactured them in the only vinyl pressing plant in the UK on heavy vinyl, 10-inch. And we've even embossed the Windmills Project logo onto the sleeve, which cost about twice as much as making the whole record itself. And now that it's come back, I am like Gollum. I don't want anyone else to have it, to tell you the truth.
How many did you have pressed? 1,000?
500.
Oh, my God.
But we now got Rough Trade want to stock some of them. And I think we're almost being forced into a corner that we have to try and sell something.
Yeah, that kind of comes with the territory at times.
Yeah, no, it's just that I love this artifact so much that it is like my ring.
Well, it's your baby.
Yeah, you know, so, we don't, you know, joking aside, but it wasn't really an idea we wanted to do the vinyl. Initially, we wanted to do just that was all we would ever do was 500 vinyl. You don't have to number them because they're embossed. Because it's not worth repressing them because they cost so much that you could never make any profit out of them. You would have to sell them at £10 each. I think they came in at about £3. It cost about £3.50 to make each one. So for us to ship them to a shop and sell them and try and make a profit is hardly worthwhile. It's just, and everybody said, it would have been half the price if you didn't want to emboss it.
Yeah, but I mean, it's your, you know, it goes back.
But that's
to,
it. I
babe.
Just said, well, look, you know, there's five. These are, you don't have to number them. It's like we wanted a limited edition item that would have some collectible. It's, you know, without being too sort of, you know, highbrow about it. We think it's a piece of art, so we don't classify it as in terms of, you know, what it's worth. We think it's an artifact, and there's only 500 of them, and then we'll never make any more ever. And I'd like at some stage, you know, for people to go, oh yeah, I've got one of those.
Well, and it also represents a moment of your life too.
Yeah, that's it. It's you know, life's more important than, you know, I mean, we're lucky. Well, I'm even luckier because I don't have a proper job. Stacey works two jobs, and Cave teaches guitar for a living, and I do nothing. So So we're kind of like, we are double blessed, really, that, you know, that we're in a situation where we can create art like this. But the idea was always to create art rather than to try and create commerce.
Nice. And it shows too in your work. I mean, I love what I hear so far, and I'm going to be following you guys.
Good. We like to hear that.
So, yeah, if you ever want us to premiere anything, just let us know.
Oh yeah, we've got the new video is just, it's not even online yet. I've just got to put it up on the Station K YouTube site, but if you want, you can have the exclusive of it if you want. It's really good. Cave has done an absolutely amazing job, because it's a party political broadcast. Because what we're going to do is we're going to release the records, all the mixes and everything are going to be available online on May the 7th to go with the general election, because what we're saying is, don't trust the politicians, don't trust big business, don't trust the media. You know, vote for something that you're interested in.
I'll tell you what. I will have this interview mixed tomorrow, and I will send you the audio, and then you send me the video.
Yeah.
And then I'll make this an exclusive on an exclusive.
Well, that's it. We haven't even put it on YouTube yet. Nobody's seen it at all. So
yeah.
So you can have it as an absolute exclusive.
Oh, that would be great. And then like I said, we'll mix the interview in with the premiere.
Yeah, yeah, perfect. Because what we'll do is we'll give you a day or so, and then we'll put it on YouTube.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. But thank you so much, man. I love it.
Absolutely. No problem. So,
well, one last question. I know we talked about this earlier, but I didn't outright ask you. Do you plan on touring anywhere?
Yeah, we want to do shows, but we want to do installations. The idea of it is that when we perform the set, it won't be like a band playing. It'll be like a repertory company. And we will do the sets, act one, act two, act three, with two intervals.
Almost like a musical.
No, not like a musical. We're not that good.
Well, a musical production with.
No, it'll be like a play.
Okay.
Like a theater, like a repertory, a theater play.
Or a performance piece.
With three acts.
Ah, okay.
And there'll be intervals. But whenever we do a show, it will always be the same tracks in the same order in the same way. And there will be no dancing, and there will be no sort of like, this is our MySpace and this is our Twitter. We will just perform the piece using animation and like a 5-piece live band and with live animation on
stage.
So that
the story is represented.
So the story is represented, and we will just play every single gig, but we'll be exactly the same. But the only difference will be that we will change the lineup every single time, so that we will get a string orchestra for one performance.
Now, you know what I can picture you picture you doing as a group. I could picture you at some point kind of doing what Pussy Riot did.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, honestly, like, you know, and what I'm talking about are like the impromptu gigs with a purpose.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I go to so many gigs and I hate people saying, oh, thank you so much. And, you know, everybody is just so sycophantic. And I always just go, get on with it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
like, just impress me, for fuck's sake.
Like everybody's trying to be One Direction or something.
Yeah, yeah, everybody is. And we don't want to do that, and we're going to have no talking. No, you know, one of my favorite groups of the 80s was Cabaret Voltaire, and they were the arch electronic experimentalists, and they never danced on stage. They never talked to the audience. And you don't need – I don't need somebody to go and tell me what his Twitter address is. I haven't come there for that.
Yeah. If you want to, you can find it.
Yeah. If I like him, I'll find it. So, you know, I think it's much more important. And we can do that, you know. I think that would be much more interesting, the installation idea. And then, you know, and if it goes well, then, you know, we've got massive plans. You know, I'd like to hire a boat and cruise around the Mediterranean and have a show in Barcelona, in Monaco, in Sardinia, in, you know, but just take a 1,000 capacity boat with a stage already set up on it. So every night, every time you land, you have performance.
So the boat becomes the stage.
The boat becomes a stage.
Nice, nice. See, I can picture you guys doing stuff like that. You know, this, all of this thinking out of the box, because the music world has become bland in the last 20 years.
That's it. Where's the interest?
Mm-hmm. So, and you know, it's funny. I mean, I hear this from bands all the time that we interview. It's always the same album tour. You know, it's like repetition. It's going around in circles.
Yeah. I've got nothing against people, you know, who are obviously trying to make careers out of being a musician or being in a band or anything. But we're not that. We're not trying to do that.
Oh, I've got nothing against them either. But I mean, it's what I always thought was what always made me wonder was how can you keep it creative when you're going around in circles like that?
Well, that's it. It's really difficult, isn't it? You know, it's like. Because I think you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, you know, because you're in a cycle.
It's that thin line where it's fun, but then it turns into a job.
There's a fine line between insanity and madness.
Yeah, exactly. And it's
as we say in our songs.
it's a fine line in a gray area.
And they think we are mad.
Exactly. Well, thanks for being on the show today, man. We really appreciate it.
No worries. We've really enjoyed it.
So, hey, the interview's over, man. So how did you like your first time out?
Yeah, pretty good. How do you think we did?
I think you did really good. I mean, I like it when it turns into a conversation, and that's what this became.
Yeah. No, me too. I don't think, you know, we don't really have a lot to sell.
So, well, actually you do, and it's a concept.
Yeah, you well, know, that's
you're,
it.
You're selling a
we're
concept.
Interested, we're all interested in the concept. It's what drives us. And we've, like, you know, we've picked up, since the three of us started, we've now got, like, you know, people in Leicester, and Nottingham, and Cumbria, you know, and London. You know, kids who have come to us and said, I'm a really wicked percussion player. I love the concept. And they're kind of joining the team. And we're going, yeah, you're in.
Exactly, man. Exactly.
And they're on the next record now, we've got, look, because the beauty about it is now with Dropbox.
Oh, yeah.
I don't have to get them to our garden shed to record. You know, I can just send them the files and say, you put your percussion down on there. And send it back to me.
And it comes back good quality, too, because
absolutely.
I mean, it is so cheap to get good equipment now.
It's amazing, you know, and we've literally got now, like, kind of, I call them cells, you know, we are ISIS. We've got cells developing everywhere, you know, but these are genuine enthusiasts, you know, young 20-year-old kids who are going, I fucking love this. And that's how, you know, if you met, you know, group, I think that you get groups and then you get movements. And, you know, the whole Manchester thing was more of a movement than about any groups. It's because all of a sudden you do something that sort of sparks a psyche of, you know, a collection of people who go, this is better than, you know, a load of dodgy rock bands. You know, all of a sudden it's like, you know, I mean... I think when I was young, I saw the Happy Mondays play to about 12 people. But they went from there to playing to 1,000 people with Paul Oakham, because all they had was a group continuously evolving into a movement.
Yeah, it was people from different groups that found a common bond.
Yeah, and that's it. And people like Paul Oakham, Fold, everybody got into it. You know, it's like... That was a fantastic feeling, you know, for someone who really, I love music, you know, I'm really passionate about it. So when I see things like that happening, that's the real deal.